Oyez, oyez, oyez.
The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket today. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060948, City of Pasadena versus Richard Smith from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070131, John Christopher Franca, M.D., versus Stacy Velasquez and others from Bexar County in the Fourth Court of Appeals District. And docket number 070697, Paul H. Smith and others versus Thomas O'Donnell from Bexar County in the Fourth Court of Appeals District. Justice Green will not be sitting in the third cause. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all arguments well before noon, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060948, City of Pasadena versus Richard Smith.
May it please the court.
Mr. Jewell will present argument on behalf of the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. Your honors, may it please the court. In the past, this court has examined, in one respect or another, Government Code Section 143.057, or its sister provision, 43.1016, which are part of Texas's civil service statute applicable to police officers and firefighters. But the court has never addressed, and in fact has expressly left open, some important statutory construction issues which are presented today. The question here is Section 143.057J, which allows limited court review of decisions of hearing examiners in three circumstances. Those when the examiner acts without jurisdiction, those where the examiner exceeds his or her jurisdiction, and when the result is procured by fraud or other unlawful means. That third scenario is not at issue here. The question the city asked this court to answer is, what is the permissible scope of appellate review under Section 143.057J? Or in other words, what does it mean for an examiner to exceed his jurisdiction, thus allowing court review? A second issue, depending on, we believe, how narrowly or how broadly the court interprets that section, is whether the section's delegation of authority is constitutional. A third potential issue, more fact-specific to this case, is whether the city's petition in district court was timely filed. I'd like to talk about the first issue and spend most of my time on that. What does it mean for a hearing examiner under Chapter 143 to exceed jurisdiction?
Can I interrupt you just for 1 minute? Sure. And ask, is it... It's undisputed that 143.1015 does not apply. Everyone agrees on that, is it?
That is an accurate statement. We certainly agree with that. The respondent has agreed with that, and the First Court of Appeals agreed with that proposition. Currently pending before this court is City of Waco versus Kelly, which is a decision that involves an appeal under this very statutory provision. During the argument in Kelly last April, Justice O'Neill asked the city's attorney about the standard under that section, and he responded with two parts to his answer. First, he said that exceeding jurisdiction would include the circumstance where an examiner forges remedies that are not authorized by statute. But he also said that he believed that that would not include clear errors of law. Now, we wholeheartedly agree with the first part of his answer, but we do not entirely agree with the second part.
Is there a case where there was a clear error of law and it was reversed?
on review?
I believe there are, and the cases that we've cited in the brief show that. Whether those decisions
think show that. They all seem to say, well, there might be, but not in this particular case.
Well, the problem with the standard, or using the words clear error of law, is that it is so broad.
Well, but I'm wondering if you have a case in which that standard or some other resulted in the reversal of the hearing examiner's decision.
I think falling into that category of cases would be the Leal decision.
Which one?
The Leal decision. In fact, I believe that Waco versus Kelly itself involves that type of issue. Of course, we don't know the result in that case yet.
I thought in Leal, that's City of Laredo against Leal. Is that the one you're referring to?
That's correct.
I have a note that it held that the hearing examiner had the statutory authority to reduce an indefinite suspension.
Let me answer your question by illustrating what I'm talking about and what we think the standard should be that applies. Those cases in the majority of the appellate courts which have addressed this issue have applied or purported to apply an abuse of authority type standard. We think that that standard should encompass situations where the examiner acts beyond the scope of the statutory authority he or she possesses. Okay, that is an error of law. We don't think the standard should necessarily encompass all errors of law because by its terms, Section 057J is necessarily restricted to situations where they cede jurisdiction. And when the appellate courts...
You cite us a number of cases that say that the real standard is an abuse of authority and that that would encompass something like this. But I just wonder if any of them have actually reversed the hearing examiner on that standard.
I can go through the decisions that I've cited in the brief and advise the court as to whether or not the result in those cases was a reversal versus a non-reversal based on the standard that we are advocating. But I think for purposes of analyzing those decisions, it's instructive to look at the types of errors that they have analyzed. And when you look at those cases, you can see that you can generally categorize those types of complaints into three groups. You have complained of errors where the examiner has, in fact, been alleged to have applied a remedy, a statute that doesn't apply, or somehow acted beyond the scope of what the authority was that he or she was vested with. You also have decisions that discuss allegations that the examiner, in applying a statute that examiner was authorized to apply, made a mistake of law by misinterpreting some part of the statute or something like that. For example, in situations where there's a limitations provisions in the statute and those are misinterpreted. And then a third example is where there's a challenge to whether or not the municipality complied with all prerequisites to invoke the examiner's jurisdiction, such as whether the suspension letter adequately advised the officer of his right to appeal to an examiner, forego commission, et cetera. I think under the standard we're proposing, an abuse of authority standard, you're looking at the first and third categories being, I think, fairly assailable on appeal under the statute, whereas the second category probably not so much.
In this case, if the hearing examiner had said, well, of course, this statute doesn't apply, but maybe the rule should be the same here. You could certainly interpret it that way. I don't know. What's everybody think? Okay, well, I think it should apply in this case. Would that be the kind of reversible error that you're arguing for?
I think it would be. Absolutely. When the examiner purports to apply a statute, what everyone agrees is outside the scope of his authority, that has to come within the purview of the examiner exceeding his jurisdiction.
Couldn't he decide, I think the chief needed to be there, chief did this, even if there'd been no statute about whether or not the chief had to be there?
I think the examiners are constrained by the scope of the statutory guidelines that are included or that define the scope
but
of their authority.
If it's a swearing match, I mean, one can imagine a case where only the chief knows the facts and the chief doesn't show up and the examiner says, you lose then.
Well, in this particular case, had the examiner had the hearing,
I know,
he would know that the chief did not only possess the facts.
But the ground that the statute is based on could be used even if the statute wasn't there in some circumstances. And then you, your argument would be it is final and binding just like the statute says.
I'm not sure that's true because Section 101.5 clearly sets forth the language about the department head presenting the grounds for the suspension, and that only the department head presents the written statement or the grounds presented in the written statement.
You're not taking into account what happens to people when they become judges. When they become judges, they say, I want that guy in here. And if that guy come in, they tend to throw the case out or punish somebody. Why couldn't a hearing examiner? It might happen to hearing examiners too, right?
That's true, but I think the hearing examiner's authority is constrained by the statute.
And well, I mean, the judges are too. The judge might get reversed for doing that kind of thing, but would be hard-pressed to say the judge had no jurisdiction.
I guess I don't agree with that completely because the statute has specifically outlined guidelines that are applicable to the situation. Our examiner was selected specifically under the terms of 057, and his authority is constrained to those provisions and those guidelines.
So when the statute says the hearing examiner's decision is final and binding, are you saying that applies only to factual findings, not to legal findings?
Yes, to the factual part, and yes, to some of the legal parts.
Which legal findings could a hearing examiner make that would still be could still be appealed under exceeded its jurisdiction?
And that goes back to the categories of types of errors that I was talking about earlier. This case involves a situation where an examiner has applied a statute which clearly has no applicability here. I think that sort of application or that sort of error of law.
So it's how wrong you are. It's not different types of legal rulings. It's just if it's really, really wrong, then you can appeal that. But it just might be wrong or probably wrong. You can't?
I believe for purposes of this case, it is sufficient for the court to hold that an application of a statute that clearly has no application is a sufficient circumstance of exceeding jurisdiction. I don't think it's necessary for the court in this case to examine all outer parameters.
It will be in the next one.
And counsel, it's important to do justice between the parties in this case, but you know, at this court we're fashioning rules that hopefully make sense across the broad spectrum of disputes. So if you're the author of the opinion, you're on the court. You get to draft the opinion. What conceptually is the rule of law you write that distinguishes between a hearing examiner getting it wrong on the law versus not having jurisdiction when he got it wrong? Because if a trial judge got it wrong on the law, we'd just say that was wrong, not necessarily no jurisdiction. What's the conceptual line you would draw?
I agree, and I think the conceptual line is inherent in the abuse of authority standard we're advocating. And I think
what does that mean?
Well, I think that it means an examiner, I think it can be fairly said that an examiner exceeds his jurisdiction when he or she abuses his authority, when they purport to act outside the sphere of their permissible authority, or when they exercise a power or grant relief that is not authorized under the statutory provisions that apply to them. And I think that would include an examiner's use of a procedural mechanism that is not available under statute, or an examiner's forcing relief that is not available under statute. These are all errors of law and should be assailable through appellate review.
So then the determining whether a hearing examiner, in your view, acted outside his jurisdiction is a different analysis from whether a trial judge acted outside his or her jurisdiction. You would draw that line differently in the hearing examiner context.
Well, I'm not sure it's different because there is precedent from this court that construes the language exceeding jurisdiction in the way that we suggest. And in particular, I'll cite the court to a couple of cases. In Cunningham versus Parkdale, which appears at 660 Southwest 2nd, 810. The court examined that phrase and applied it to a trial court and held that the trial court had exceeded jurisdiction by taking action that was not authorized by statute. Also, in a case called Northline versus Compton at 618 Southwest 2nd, 534, jurisdiction by reinstating a case after it had been dismissed and after his plenary power had expired.
I think those cases. Quick question. You can tackle this more on rebuttal, but assuming we decide the statute permits no appeal, can you kind of tackle the constitutional point for us? You can pick it up again on rebuttal, but
allows no appeal?
Right.
I think that's a significant constitutional problem. And I can talk more about that on rebuttal, and I will. But, of course, we've set out in the brief how we think the Boll-Weevil factors come down. But I think that if the court interprets Section 057J to allow for meaningful review in the sense of an abuse of authority or some comparable standard, that may be sufficient enough under the Constitution to survive. But the narrower the scope of appellate review gets, I think the greater constitutional problem exists. The first factor under Boll-Weevil, I think, is the most critical here, because that factor goes to whether or not there is meaningful appellate review. And that factor strikes to the heart of what the constitutional inquiry is all about, because the driving force behind that issue is an examiner's arbitrary exercise of power. This court has acknowledged that concern in Proctor versus Andrews and other cases in which it's examined these constitutional delegations of authority. I'll pick up with that on rebuttal.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jewell. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Waddell will present arguments for the respondent. The Solicitor General, Mr. Ho, will present argument for the state of Texas. Ms. Waddell will open with the first 15 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court. May it please the court. As two bases upon which, or two grounds upon which, this court should affirm the first court of appeals. The first, which I will not discuss this morning unless the court has questions, is whether or not the city timely filed their appeal with the district court. It's our position that they did not. I'll pick that up at the end if there are any questions. With respect to the second ground that requires affirmance, is that the first court of appeals was correct in its reading of Section 057J of Chapter 143 of the Local Government Code. That court's interpretation was reasonable, and it comported with this court's decision in Houston v. Clark, which plainly said errors of law aren't reviewable under 057J, and that's
no matter how egregious.
Right, that's what this court said in Houston v. Clark. That's my understanding.
Well, in case we weren't so sure, can you just not imagine any error that would be bad enough that it would require reversal? If suppose the hearing examiner said, well, I know these are the rules and regulations of the police department, but I don't agree with them. They shouldn't be. And I'm not going to follow. He was suspended for doing this, and I disagree with that. I'm not going to suspend him.
Okay. Actually, that kind of outer margin issue is, I think, picked up under the way the exceeds jurisdiction language has been defined under the arbitration context with respect to manifest disregard of the law, which was what I suggested in my brief. Should this court find that the provisions, the interpretation of 057J by the First Court of Appeals does court constitutional problems with respect to the delegation issue, I suggested that possibly the use of the review standards under the Arbitration Act in Texas might be applicable and might be assist in allowing for a slightly broader interpretation of what exceeds jurisdiction.
Well,
means.
Why wouldn't this be? It seems that all parties agree that the examiner manifestly disregarded the law here. So why wouldn't, under that standard, we reverse?
Okay, because actually we do not, the hearing examiner in this case made a technical mistake, but he listened very carefully to the arguments made to him.
It's not really a technical mistake. I mean, the city can't go forward.
Well, in his decision, he wrote, pursuant to 1015, you know, I see that the law requires that the chief be present. Okay. But he listened to an evidentiary argument presented to him by Officer Smith's counsel and a response from the city, and that argument was essentially that Officer Smith has the right to confront his accuser. And the chief is the person that decided to fire him, and the chief is the one that signed the notice of suspension. So, you know, it's logical to require him to be here, and it would avoid any potential hearsay problems. So that was Smith's counsel's argument. The response by the city was, well, you know, we got this other guy here who was there when the chief signed it and, you know, was involved, so he could address those questions. But he's not the person that made the decision, and this is important. Officer Smith was terminated from his job that he was good at and he enjoyed.
Did the examiner specifically reference 1015?
No. During the hearing before him, Officer Smith's counsel handed the examiner a copy of 1015 and said, you know, for guidance, this is what the section 1015 requires, that the chief be here, which, you know, and the underlying basis for that is the same kind of argument that Officer Smith's counsel was making, that, you know, Officer Smith has the right to confront his accuser. He should be here. So the basis underlying 1015 makes sense and comports with the argument. The hearing examiner listened to it. Plus, you know, chapters A through F of 143, which actually apply to the city of the size of Pasadena, don't say that the hearing examiner don't set out who needs to be present, and doesn't say that the hearing examiner can't require people that he thinks are necessary, like Justice Brister was alluding to, who's necessary to present the case. It doesn't say he doesn't have the authority to do that. He's empowered to hear the case and can decide who he thinks is necessary to be there.
If that were the case, would the ruling be a dismissal, or would it be a ruling on the merits? I understand the examiner here dismissed the case because of the lack of the chief's presence.
Yes, he did that. But, you know, the hearing examiner process is an adversarial proceeding. There were two people in front of him, and nobody said, well, we understand that you think, you know, the chief needs to be here, and, you know, that's a reasonable request. He's not
present. I'm just saying that the argument you're making, I can understand it, that as Justice Brister said, you know, we need the guy here, and if he's not here, then you're going to lose. But that's very different from saying, you know, he's not here, and the statute requires his presence as a jurisdictional matter, so I cannot hear the case, which is, everyone agrees, is not what that statute doesn't apply to that circumstance.
True. There isn't a statutory admonition under chapters A through F, but he has the authority, number one, to decide who he needs to have in front of him. Number two, hearing examiners are empowered to grant motions to dismiss, like in the Longoria case. You know, the city, Mr. Longoria, brought a motion to dismiss based on the 180 days requirement under 152H. And the hearing examiner listened to that and said, you know, you're right. They didn't bring the charges within the period allowed under the statute, and therefore the statute hasn't been complied with, and you haven't. Your notice of suspension is deficient. And he dismissed it right there. That's the same thing that this hearing examiner did. He had the authority to determine who needed to be in front of him. He's conducting the hearing. Nobody in front of him said, well, we understand this is what you think. Could we have a continuance and go get the chief and we'll come back? Nobody did that. So, and they understood what his position was. So I think the way that hearing was conducted, the arbitrator was clearly explaining his position, the parties understood it, and the basis was sound because it's an evidentiary issue.
So you think it would be a different case if the examiner said flat out, I am applying 1015 to this case. The chief is not here. I'm dismissing it. You think that would be a different case than if there were this discussion about hearsay and the need to have him in front and be able to confront the witness, that sort of thing? In the former, then we would have the ability to reverse. In the latter, it's just a legal error.
Actually, no. Under the standard, no. That's an interpretive issue, and that's within the province of the hearing examiner.
But I still don't understand why virtually everything isn't under your position. You say manifest disregard, but we can't think of a case.
Well, if that's true,
then the hearing examiner is really setting policy, and unreviewable policy. Not even the commission can do that.
Well, I don't think he's setting policy. He's interpreting the statute. He is limited to the statute in front of him. If he's not proceeding under the statute, I think...
Well, he didn't hear.
Well, actually, he...
It just doesn't apply.
Well, that's within Section 1015, so it is within Chapter 143, but...
I mean, he could have said the discipline has to be on blue paper, and it's not.
Well, okay.
So he said, so I'm dismissing it.
That, I think, would be encompassed by the manifest disregard of the law, because that is clearly a bad faith reason for depriving, in this instance, for depriving somebody of their employment. I think, you know, flipping a coin and making a decision that way would be encompassed by the manifest disregard of the law.
Why? How do we tell the difference?
Because that entails a measure of bad faith, and it also entails a measure of failing to render a thoughtful, honest judgment. When you just go outside and flip a coin without any respect to...
That's the standard. How do we know this hearing examiner didn't just make up his mind that he was going to dismiss the city's appeal and just say, well, this statute applies, and... I think it applies, and that's good enough to hang my hat on. How do we look into his mind if the standard is bad faith and we look into the hearing examiner's mind? That seems to be pretty nebulous.
Well,
Counsel, I want you to answer that question, of course, but also the SG's time is ready. But please answer the question. I don't want to cut you off.
Okay. Actually, there are lots of standards of review that require an inquiry into the intent of the individual that made the decision. Like Title VII, it requires that. It's difficult to prove, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. And especially if a hearing examiner says something like, I want it on blue paper, I think, you know, that's a manifest disregard of the law. That's like saying, I'm going to rule for the person who's most attractive. You know, that's a manifest disregard of the law, and it's abrogating their duty to do something like that. But in this case, because of Proctor and the statements you made in Proctor with respect to the AAA and the FMCS, making sure the individuals hearing those cases are qualified and trained to hear them, I don't think we're going to encompass problems like that. But if that occurred, I think the manifest disregard of the law would be the appropriate standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, all arbitration inherently involves the delegation of some measure of governmental power to private parties. So as a constitutional matter, Section 057 is really no different than either the Texas Arbitration Act or the Federal Arbitration Act. Determining the appropriate standard of judicial review under any of these laws is strictly an interpretive issue, not a constitutional one. In fact, to accept the city's position here would essentially require a significant and surprising departure from this Court's recent and unanimous rulings in Houston versus Clark and Proctor versus Andrews, not to mention a recent ruling of the United States Supreme Court in Hall Street Associates versus Mattel. In my limited time, I would like to respond to three of the questions that have been raised this morning. First, I think Justice Heck mentioned, asked, does it matter, you know, no matter how egregious, there's absolutely no review whatsoever. We would submit, first of all, not at all. We would submit that the court essentially already took care of this issue when it enumerated eight factors, not just one factor, in Bollweevil and Proctor. Specifically, the factor that requires the selection of qualified delegates of governmental power. We're talking here about the AAA that is specifically vested with the power. In Proctor, this court not only said that the selection itself is not an improper delegation, but not acknowledged that selection of these arbitrators we can respect as qualified individuals to receive governmental delegation to decide this case. This review standard essentially is the same struggle that this court has been seeing in the TAA, the Texas Arbitration Act issue, which contains remarkably similar language, very restricted judicial review, and a specific statement that suggests that other than the statutory standards, you can go no further.
But the difference here is that that absence of review allows the arbitrator to do almost anything he wants. And in doing so, set policy for the government.
Well, I think that's the same struggle that we're seeing in the TAA context, where essentially there's no merits review. There is a struggle about, at the outer margins, what do you do if there is...
But that's between two litigants. That's between two disputers. But here, one of the disputants is the city, and the city has policies about how the police department or the fire department ought to be operated. And the arbitrator doesn't have to follow those.
Well, we would submit that perhaps at the outer margins of the word jurisdiction, you can imagine a situation where the hearing examiner is essentially saying, I recognize the law is X, I just don't care. I'm going to follow a totally different law. You can imagine a definition of jurisdiction that is sufficiently malleable that it would cover at least that much. We would submit that that is not a merits ruling. It's essentially a sort of a bad faith, dishonest judgment standard, much like the gross mistake common law standard that the court has talked about. With regard to this particular case, we would note that on the issue of Section 101.5, the state does not fully agree with the parties that the statute has absolutely no bearing. It is certainly strictly not applicable to this case, but as I think Justice Tucker noted, there would be no problem with citing a statute for guidance. The right to confront one's accusers is certainly a traditional rule that a hearing examiner could consider sort of as a default principle. This is essentially an evidentiary ruling that the hearing examiner decided without that particular testimony, the hearing examiner was just not going to be convinced of the merits of the city's position. Perfectly reasonable fact resolution. And in fact, the city concedes that there is literally no resolution, no review of fact questions as here. Finally, there was a question about whether or not there are any cases dealing with mistake of law. We would submit that this court has essentially answered that question, certainly in the Clark case, where the court unanimously said you're restricted in your review to just what the statute provides, and clearly the statute does not provide for review of merely mistake of law. We'd also submit that Callahan and CVN Group, which are TAA cases, admittedly, but under this very similar language under TAA, basically the court indicated no review of pure, just sole mistake of law issues. The city relies solely on cases that either precede or essentially ignore this court's ruling in Clark. Their analysis is essentially untethered to the text. And again, we would submit that jurisdiction, at a minimum, means power. And certainly, the hearing examiner, like any court, has the power to interpret laws, including the power to interpret laws differently than perhaps this court might. If there are no other questions, Your Honors.
Yeah, counsel, on the constitutional analysis, does the fact that there's an option to go to the commission where there is clear judicial review versus going to the hearing examiner where there's very limited review, does that have any impact on the constitutionality of the provision we're looking at today?
It certainly could, Your Honor. I mean, that is absolutely an option where there would be de novo review. I think our submission would be, even under the hearing examiner process, that is still meaningful review, and it certainly satisfies all eight factors, the remaining factors. It's not just about meaningful review. Otherwise, Proctor would have come out precisely the opposite if that were the only issue.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very quickly, in response to Justice Heck's question about whether there has been a case that applies an abuse of authority standard and finds that the examiner exceeds his jurisdiction, I'll cite the court to a recent opinion from Dallas called Kirkendall versus City of Grand Prairie. I do not have the Westlaw cite, but the Court of Appeals cause number is 0507788CV. Kirkendall versus City of Grand Prairie, and in that case, the court examined under 057J whether or not an examiner applied a remedy that was outside the scope of his authority, held that it could review that issue under an abuse of authority standard, and in fact found that the examiner exceeded his jurisdiction. Chief Justice Jefferson asked a question about the grounds on which our examiner relied and whether he specifically referenced Section 1015. He did. If you'll see in the record, the written decision of the examiner, he references that section in that decision, and he makes very clear that he is applying that section. It wasn't just brought up at the hearing, He, in fact, decided the case based on that provision.
Do we have any studies or information about how often these hearing examiners are used versus the commission procedure?
I can't point to a study, and my answer to that question would be mostly anecdotal, but this comes up quite frequently. Cities deal with these examiners on a weekly basis, and these questions come up repeatedly. So there's a very high frequency, and that's why this is so important, I think, to the state.
How are they selected?
They're selected from a list of arbitrators under the process under Chapter 143. So the AAA will give a list of arbitrators, and then people go through them and
select. Right, they strike like three, and you get two strikes or something like that, and the last one remains.
Right.
The cities don't have to do this. They have to opt into this regime.
That's correct.
That's and 140 some have, according to your brief.
That's correct.
Some
That's
correct.
On the constitutional question, Your Honor, given your question, assuming that the court finds there is no review, I think that would implicate several factors under the Boweevil test. Not only the first one, which speaks to meaningful court review, but also the sixth factor. As to whether or not the delegation is broad or narrow, because if there is, in fact, no appellate review, then that would result in a very effective broad delegation of power. Now, Garland versus Byrd, when it analyzed the constitutionality issue under 057J, it concluded that the sixth factor weighed neither in favor or against the constitutionality, but you'll recall Byrd interpreted Section 057J to provide for meaningful appellate review, as it held that an abuse of authority type standard would apply to that. And so it acknowledged that there was some appellate review available. But I think that the narrower the court construes the scope of review, the greater the constitutionality problems come into play.
Even though the officer elected that route? And take the arbitration example that was proposed. A party can seek to resolve the dispute through arbitration or elect to go through the courts, given depending on the contract that the parties entered in advance, if there was one. And if there wasn't, the parties can still elect arbitration. And there's very limited review. Does that draw into question the constitutionality of arbitration? Analogously here, officer could go through the commission and have clear appellate court review and instead opted to go through the hearing examiner where there's very limited review. So I guess my question again is, how does that implicate the constitutionality of this when there's an option to choose no appellate review or very limited appellate review?
Well, there is, of course, an acknowledged right to appellate review of arbitration awards, and I don't equate the two.
It's very limited.
It is limited, as ours should be limited, and Justice West's question was assuming there was no appellate review. I don't equate the arbitration process with the examiner process, although I think
they are. And I didn't hear it equated. I heard that it was analogous.
Right, it was analogous. But I think the court has to examine this statute on its own independent whether it stands on its own independent legs. And it can look to the standards in the arbitration process, but I think that the court's decision here ought to be guided by what the appellate courts have done in our case and what this court has held in terms of construing the phrase exceeding jurisdiction. One point I'd like to add to that is I know in the briefing, Smith has argued that the common law standards for review of arbitration awards should apply. And I'm not sure that position helps them because there are cases which have held that under the common law, arbitration awards can be vacated for errors of law or in situations where the arbitrator exceeds authority.
Well, Justice Wirt has pressed a button. I think that means the argument is over. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess after one question.
Answer on this. Does the city concede that there is some time limit, some number of days, that it has to appeal from the hearing examiner's decision?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
All rise.